Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's Monthly Leadership Forum. Today we're excited to have Dr. Daphne Scott. Daphne brings two decades of real-world coaching and corporate development experience to her work with organizations, teams, and individuals. She combines strong leadership abilities with highly trained facilitation skills to bring individuals and teams into greater relationship, creativity, and ultimately success. Daphne is the founder of DS Leadership Life and the Chief Culture Officer at Confluent Health. She's an expert at waking up leaders to mindful way of leading, and given her improv comedy training, she brings a unique sense of humor to her work, helping merge companies into great cultures. She's a certified mindfulness meditation teacher and a professional coach. She's certified as a Hendrick coach and a founding member of the Conscious Leadership Group. She's also a member of the International Coaching Federation. Daphne holds a Master's of Applied Positive Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania and Doctorate of Science in Physical Therapy from Andrews University. She hosts the Super Fantastic Leadership Show podcast and the series Leadership in the Driver's Seat on her YouTube channel. You sound like my son with your YouTube channel. I like it. he's talking about his five YouTube channels all the time. Her latest book is called Waking Up a Leader, The Five Relationships of Success. You can find Daphne on Twitter at Daphne Scott, that's D-A-P-H-N-E Scott. And her website is www.daphne-scott.com/. So for those of you joining us for the first time, I will tell you that this is our, I think, 16th year of doing this. And we do it every month. We have a topic every month. Last year we had with AI and society, and this year our topic is basically stress, anxiety, complexity, but it's basically how do we deal with this effed up world of ours is really what this is about. So we wanted to have Daphne talk with us a little bit about that. So before we get into your ideas around stress and such, I wanted to understand a little bit about your journey, because I just read your bio, but that isn't necessarily your journey.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear from you, especially the comic part, about your journey and how you began your career in this field.
Yeah, thanks. Well, even listening to my bio, it sounded exhausting to me. so I'd say that my journey really was born out of my own, I guess the word I'll use is suffering, in a way that I was on the path of really wanting to, you know, achieve things and accomplish things, as many of us are, right? And really got taken away with a lot of it, and taken away by it. And at the same time, got into my first leadership role when I was about 5 years into my career, and was horrible at it. And so I wouldn't say I was the best manager or leader at the time. I was all of 30 years old. And, I just had my own, really a lot of the path that I started on, my own path of waking up, really was born out of my own suffering and just wanting to get a handle on some of those things and be a better person. And also I had just started having really just these, levels of anxiety. Like I wasn't sleeping. Mm-hmm. I was waking up in the middle of the night. And so a lot of it was just my own search for a greater level of understanding and wanting to be better at my job, you know, better in my career. I knew I always wanted to be a manager and a leader of sorts. And I had that sort of wired into me for some reason. And yet I just didn't have the skills to do it very well. You know, I didn't understand why people just wouldn't listen to me and do what I tell them to do, you know. so all those things sort of happened seemingly simultaneously. And I just started on this path of wanting to, you know, understand myself and understand others better. And thus, here I am now, you know, a whole book later, I guess.
Since we're talking about stress and anxiety mostly this year, and I know there's this, you know, just an article and a lot of articles in Harvard Business Review lately about mental health, how to manage stress. I mean, it's just like we've been talking about this for years and years, but I think that finally the literature is trying to keep up with us here.
You're right.
So, how do you see yourself as a stress expert? What does that really mean? Like, how do you talk to people about that?
Yeah. It first is starting out with a few things I think people, need to really define for themselves, in that, one thing that's stressful for you, for example, might not be stressful for me. Now we have to define really what we mean by stress. Like, some stress is good, if we want to get stronger, if we want our bodies to get stronger, for example, we stress the muscles, right?
Mm-hmm.
We go to the gym, we work out, we do all these sorts of things. And that does put our bodies under stress. Now, what's usually for most of us different is that we do that for 45 minutes or an hour or what have you, and the body gets a certain level of recovery, right? The mind, unfortunately, doesn't work that way sometimes. It has its own ideas. And so when we are putting ourselves in situations, so that's the first place in situation circumstances where there can be high levels of stress, then it's sort of like we don't get a break from it. Coupled with, as I said, something that might be stressful to you isn't stressful for me. And what we start to learn is that we have these different ways that we relate to things that can either increase, right? That it's how we sort of are seeing the world that can add stress to an already stressful situation. So, for example, someone losing their job or having to tell a group of people, today's going to be your last day here, or, next week we're going to lay you off and that sort of thing. Those are certainly stressful moments. But what typically happens is we add to the stress by the way that we're relating to that experience. So we either resist it, which when unfavorable, non-preferred events happen in our lives, you'll notice that our first response is to want to fight with it, resist what's happening, try to say to ourselves it shouldn't be happening when in fact it is happening. And subsequently, we can do the opposite with good things. We can have good things happen in our lives and good moments happen in our lives, and we find ourselves wanting to hang on to them. Which is impossible too, because the good times, just like any moment in our lives, it will come and go. So we add to the events of our lives quite a bit. And there's sort of a metaphor that we can use for that. It's like adding a second arrow. You've already gotten hit once or wounded once or something non-preferred has happened. And then we add to it by the way that we might be thinking about it, talking about it, relating to it at the root. So the real path for people, first and foremost, is to understand how that works for them. I start a lot with, which comes a lot from the cognitive behavioral world, around what are the stories we're telling ourselves? What are the thoughts that we notice, pop up? And this isn't anything new, by the way, since the early 60s. But what are the thoughts that we're telling ourselves, the stories we're telling ourselves that are really adding stress to this already, less than savory event that might be happening? And then we do this other thing where our lives are actually going along pretty well, but we notice that we are always sort of searching for the thing that could go wrong. Like, this is what the mind and the brain is, a prediction machine. And you're right. I love that you said about it seems like the literature is finally starting to catch up with what so many people have been talking about forever, right? But we've done it sort of in the deep recesses of the office or in our own lives, because this thing about the way our mind works has had to remain a secret, for some reason. But mental health, has a stigma around it, which is really sort of goofy once you get underneath it, because there are no new thoughts, really. There are no new stressful thoughts, really. And so we start to see where the mind works, and the brain, the mind really is, and the brain itself are, it's a prediction machine. It's just always going through the world, like, this should be this way. I left my house this one way, therefore I predict that when I come home, it will look exactly the same. When I come home and my TV is gone, the door has been left open, it seems like some things are missing. Immediately your mind says, this isn't right. Someone else has been in here, sort of thing, which happened to me once, which is also an interesting experience when my house got broken into. So, when the mind can predict pretty well, we feel pretty safe, but it's always sort of trying to anticipate what might go wrong, and we can get caught up in that out into the future. And the longer we spend thinking about the future compulsively, right? Not when we're intentionally planning something, but compulsively thinking about it, we just naturally experience higher levels of anxiety. So It's a very long answer to stress, but that's kind of, you know, I try to, when I work with people, to really get them to see, you know, how does it work for them? How do they actually create stress, more stress in their life? And even when, you know, less than preferred things happen to us, which does happen, right? It isn't that we're supposed to ignore those situations, but that's a big overview of stress.
I realize there's like so many things I want to unpack over here. let's start. Yeah, there's like, okay, good, that will keep us going for the rest of our time together. Okay. So let's first talk about this arrow. I love this concept or metaphor about an arrow. Like something happens, mm-hmm. And we add an arrow, so our thoughts make it, we ruminate. Okay, that's one. So
yeah.
Stress isn't really stress until we ruminate. We
that's
ruminate
right.
about it. So what we're ruminating about is about either the past or the future. So then we're already putting ourselves in the past or the future and not the present. So the Buddhists would say, of course, that most of our stress is caused from our suffering because we're not in the present moment. Of course, that's just a simple, wonderfully simple, nice idea.
Simple, yeah.
But just to take that for a second, you talked about stories we tell about each other. About ourselves. And those stories are typically because from the past. Let's about what could happen and what did happen and how that affects us. Let's talk about that.
That's right.
A second, because I want you to unpack that, but also, of course, talk about what we can do about it. That's what we're here for today. Is what are we gonna do about it? We can say yes, that happens. But then what do we do about the stories we're telling ourselves in the past and the future?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's a great question. So, you know, another metaphor that I like to use, because I think this is really sort of at the root of this whole thing, is, you know, it's real basic. If a coat falls off of a hanger, you know, the simple thing to do is simply put the coat back on the hanger, right? So if you kind of keep that metaphor,
needs to go in the wash.
Right?
Maybe it needs to go in the wash.
Yeah. Maybe it does need to go wash, right?
Yeah.
But to your very clever point there, the whole point is that there's just a real simple action that might need to be taken, right? But often what we do, something less than savory happens, and the coat falls off the hanger, and we freak out. You know, we talk about how horrible this is, and that coat should have stood on the hanger, and should have stayed there, and I don't know why Cindy didn't put it on the hanger more securely, and you know, Tom in accounting really knew we needed more hangers, and this coat can't be on this hanger. And meanwhile, the coat is still laying on the floor. And so your question about the stories and the way, you know, when something sort of doesn't happen the way we would have preferred, that is the second arrow that we start adding to it, is wanting to get into blaming, into criticism, judgment, which is the path of leaving the present moment. That's really what you're mm-hmm. talking about. So the present moment could be, the coat is on the floor. Well, I notice I'm feeling a little disappointed this moment that the coat fell off the hanger. Like, we don't have to ignore our moment by moment experience. And yet at the same time, we don't have to get so caught up in it that we drift into story, we drift into the mind, either going into the past or the future, and are not able to stay with what's really here now and what's being called for now. And that's really where mm-hmm. our wisdom lives, you know, it lives in that a moment by moment. And even just like my languaging now, like it really slows down, you know, it lives in that moment by moment presence and moment by moment awareness to be able to get to that. So when you talk about what to do, I mean, this is really the, this is the whole thing. Like I talk about it, like you're sort of laughing, like be present, you know, you're like, yeah, okay. Easier said than done. And it is. So it's worth us taking the space in our lives to really see how the mind works and then to start to work with it and to train it. It's sort of this unbridled sort of wild horse, you know, or kind of a, because of our egoic and our identity attachments, it kind of reminds me of like a little yappy dog, you know, it's never quite satisfied. I was actually had this experience about a week ago where I was, it was about 2 weeks ago now, but I was on a plane and I noticed I was trying to, there's a bent page on this magazine, you know how they put the magazines in the back of the pockets of the plane and the page is kind of bent over, and I was kind of trying to straighten it up, you know. And yeah, it was like wrinkled. And so I'm kind of straightening it up. And about 5 seconds in, I realized, I'm like, what are you doing? Like, this thing is fine. And I just spent like 20 seconds of my life trying to bend this back. And the guy sitting next to me, I noticed him watching me. And he looked over at me. And I'm like, how does it look now? Does it look nice and straight? He goes, you've done an excellent job of, you know, he even realized, like, with me, like, how funny this was that I was trying to, you know, straighten this magazine corner up. But we all have some version of that. You know, we just sort of get caught up in like, oh, it should look like this. And then when you get it just like you want it, then you need it a different way. And so it's just never sort of satisfied. And therefore, we're never really in the present moment enjoying what we have now, or even when the coat falls off the hanger, having the awareness enough to really say, well, what's required right now? You know, what's required right now? And what's required right now for me?
I want to go back to what you said before, because I think you kind of gave the answer. I think at least one answer, because there's many answers, but to the question of what can we do.
So many answers.
Because I think that what you said, this is, you just said it kind of as a throwaway. I want to come back to it. Because you said, coat, I love it, the analogy of the coat. The coat fell off, and so the first thing we could do is say, am I noticing the coat fell off? I'm noticing right now that the coat fell off the hanger. So the idea of noticing, noticing, and saying that to ourselves, and also saying it to others, hey, I just noticed the coat, it could be even just right after, I just noticed the coat fell off the hanger, and actually narrating that move, if you will, alone can save us from a lot.
Yeah.
Like 50%. Just by using the word notice, it slows us down, and it gets us to present. So we're assessing. So I think of it as you're assessing what's going on. That seems like a little more strong word, I guess, but I like the word notice too. But assessing what's going on, maybe narrating that, and then saying what's required of the situation, which I love too. I think that, and of course, I'm all about the future in action. I'm going to get. I'm already asking you how to do that first thing out of the gate here.
Yeah.
But I think that we have to first realize that. One, if we can just say what we notice, that alone will allow us not to overreact. So you're not going to jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
We talk about the ladder of inference a lot, you know, in our work, and you're not going to jump to conclusions about what the hell the coach did on the floor until you notice the coach before in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, I too am a big fan of the word notice, because what is more possible, the possibility there is, you know, I noticed you're doing your best to let go of like you said, assessment, the evaluation, like of a judgment, you know, it's like, oh, that stupid coat fell off the hanger, you know, noticed that, right? It's like you really are doing your best. It's a more likely way through our languaging to kind of what I like to say is like back us into this idea of non-judgment, of non-attachment, which to your point, absolutely can start to free us from this additional stress that we can add to a situation. So yeah, you're exactly right. Being able to notice, and that's really in the first part of my book, it's really about that in training ourselves to be able to pay attention, right, in a particular way. Like really, Jon Kabat-Zinn says this, and I really love it. He says, nobody has ever been in the shower. And you know, it's like what he was saying about that was just we go on so much autopilot in our lives, and we're not really, our mind and body aren't really ever in the same place at the same time. And research really shows us that's actually pretty stressful. We get, even when we're doing something we might not necessarily say that we enjoy that much, you know, when we're really able to be present with it, we get so much more enjoyment out of it. You know, we actually enjoy our life a lot more, like even so much as brushing our teeth, you know.
Don't go that far.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not particularly get jazzed about brushing my teeth, but, you know, it's like I like to pick on that one a lot because it's just something that hopefully all of us do on a regular basis. And we sort of, you know, we're just sort of brushing our teeth. We're thinking about what we got to do tomorrow, and we're thinking about what that person said to us, you know, 5 minutes before, and how did that phone call go, and all these sorts of things. We're never really ever brushing our teeth, right? So we can get a lot more out of it with, to your, you know, you brought up ruminating, you know, our mind just wandering all over the place. And we're not noticing what we're doing here now, you know. We're not really with the person we're with now, and then we miss out on all of these nuances and things. So, yeah, really great noticing, absolutely. And then just getting our mind sort of geared, training it in a way so that it starts to learn how to pay attention. And I think that's really, I think that's really the big part of the practice.
So attention is certainly harder to come by these days than it was even 5 years ago. I think with, and then of course 10 years ago is when the iPhone came around, and it's actually 2009. Mm-hmm. So as much as I love my iPhone, as much as I, you know, I don't even know how many hours I've on it. I won't even like look at that stat. But I mean, I actually don't read books anymore. I just read on my iPhone. I mean, I'm constantly reading, and I'm reading in the car. I mean, it's bad. However, I do have rules around it in terms of it not distracting me so much that I'm not attentive to the person I'm with. I do my best. I don't think I'm great, but I think I do all right. So I think that what I want to talk about now is attention, because I think that this idea of even noticing requires that you have to pause, you have to slow down. I like to say slow down to go fast. Like, we have to slow down to get better at something, ultimately. And so that, it's just the world we live in right now is actually, it's far worse than it ever was. And with AI, it's going to get worse. I mean, it's not going to get better. It's what's going to require us to be mindful and to be facile in this ourselves. Like, no one's going to teach us to do this. We have to do it ourselves.
That's correct.
So I know that you've got some things in your book around this in terms of the relationships that require attention if you want to thrive. And I want you to, you know, walk us through those five relationships and why they're important, and anything else you can speak to in terms of attention. And then right after we do that, then I'll open this up for questions.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so the five relationships I talk about in the book are the way that we relate to some of these constructs, time, money, the self, which is around how we see ourselves, how we're relating to this identity that we've created for ourselves, friends, friendships, and then this experience that we reliably have of being in the unknown, so our relationship to the unknown. And, you know, when you talk about paying attention, I think a few things that come out of that, and I really appreciate you bringing that up, you know, how we're going to take care of this ourselves, right? Which I prefer in some ways anyhow. So, you know, having some, like you said, rules, boundaries around how much we're engaging with these different parts of our world, technology and such, which I find, again, I don't find phones a problem. I don't find any of this a problem. I think where it becomes a problem for us is when we are not intentional about how we're engaging with those things. And, you know, I think all of it has its place. And we do need to be really, really intentional about what that looks like. And these devices are designed in many ways to do exactly what they were meant to do, to keep us using them and to keep us engaged with different platforms, social media and the like. And so that's, you know, what they're designed to do. So if we know that, we know they're designed to do that, then we can say, well, okay, it's designed to keep me engaged. So it's going to be impacting me in some way, most of it sort of underneath our own awareness. Therefore, I think it's just better to have boundaries around it. You know, I had this one client who's like, he gets home at night, he literally puts his phone in a box, you know, he's just not even going to let it be an issue. It's just like, you know, horrible junk food that we can eat. If you really don't want to eat it, the best way to not eat that at 6 o'clock at night is not have it in your house, because it's designed to do one thing and one thing only, and that's to keep you eating it, you know? So mm-hmm. if you really understand that, we can get into all the different philosophical, theoretical arguments about that, but best just to, you know, put the boundaries around it. So that with that being said, we also can look at then how, like, for example, this idea around time, if we all pay attention really closely, what we find is that we've been conditioned into this idea, into this experience on some level that we'll never have enough time. We never have enough. Like, we always, or like so many people just, I give talks on this and I'll ask a whole audience, like thousands of people, you know, how many of you, you know, have experience of never feeling like you have enough time? Everyone's hands will go up, you know? And I like right. to just say, like, I know, I couldn't get 1,000 people to agree on something if I tried, right? But that one, they'll all agree on. And so, coming back to paying attention, if we pay attention again to where our mind goes, how it thinks about things, we can see that we get caught up in this thought process, these sort of thoughts that just arise out of nowhere. You're not going to have enough time. You're never going to have enough time. And I'll share an actual experience with you to illustrate my point. When I used to treat patients, you know, I'd come in on Monday morning and I'd get there early and I'd look at my schedule, you know, and just be patient, very full. And I'd start worrying myself immediately. Oh my gosh, how am I going to handle this day? I'm never going to have enough time to get my paperwork done. I'm not going to have enough time to make these phone calls. And what would inevitably happen was two or three people would cancel. You know, like the schedule never stayed the way that I thought it, right? And I learned very quickly, I'm like, wow, you're really worrying yourself and concerning yourself and telling yourself all of these stories, of which, by the way, you have been conditioned into, that you're not going to have enough time. You're not going to have enough space in your life. And once I started putting that to the test, I started really like, is that true that you really won't? And certainly, I could take on too many tasks and be over obligated and say yes to a lot of things I really didn't want to be doing, which would also make it feel like, I mean, if you want to just keep yourself in the space of never feeling like you have enough time, just keep saying yes to a lot of things that you don't want to do, you know, it'll never feel like you have enough time. So I think that's one of the ways we need to learn to pay attention. One of the ways that learning to pay attention can really help us, because we get really, and this is more the transformational bucket for sure, we get really aware of how we get caught up in these sort of conditioned patterns and thinking. Now, same thing goes true with money. At the root, we get conditioned into thinking that more money will make us more happy. More money will make us more, you know, satisfied and at peace in our lives. And for sure, there can be some little bits of truth to that on some level. However, not really that much truth at all. So, you know, we can find ourselves living like, well, one day if, or one day when, then I'll let myself, right, enjoy my life. So if we really can pay attention to those moments, and see how we're, you know, relating to these different constructs, you know, money's a construct, time's a construct, as an example, we really can start to have some greater levels of peace and calm, you know, regardless of those external circumstances. And I think that's really where paying attention to your point, not being distracted all the time, really makes a big difference. And we can take better care of ourselves that way too. Yeah.
So let's go over the five again. I know you didn't go over them specifically, but there's time, money.
Yeah.
What was the other three?
Self. The self. So our identity. Yeah, that's a big one. That one's intentionally in the middle of the five, by the way.
Yeah, friend.
So the self, and then friend. And then the unknown. Yeah.
So we picked, right, as you can imagine, we picked this particular topic this year because I think that there's quite a few things, well, particularly there's going to be one particular thing that's going to happen this year that is very unknown. It can't be more unknown by the day than it is right now, which is our election. And that's the U.S. election.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we've all been through many elections, many of us on the phone.
Yes.
And this one might be the most... what I want. Unknown. I mean, it's probably the most, I was with some friends the other day, and as an example, 10 of us, and we all know each other, you know, I said, who do you want for president? And we had four different answers within 10 of us. So to me, that's pretty unpredictable. So this is causing, I think, maybe some low level or maybe high level stress that maybe we haven't experienced before. I think that there's some definite correlations or not correlations, relationships between politics and society, of course, politics and business. And sure. I probably would go out on a limb to say that this is probably more unknown and unpredictable and complex than maybe I've seen it. Because of the way it was infiltrating business, it typically hasn't. I mean, it hasn't as much in my experience. So part of the reason why we wanted to have this topic is because I think that, you know, the work that we do as coaches is a lot about overwhelm, stress, you know, how you're going to work with your peers. I mean, I think that that's probably the number one thing, right? I work with people in terms of how you're going to influence your peers, how you're going to collaborate with your peers, but that's stressful. But I think that there is this underlying thing going on. And tell me how you're seeing this and if it's something in your practice that you're noticing. And to me, it's not just an individual thing. It's like almost a collective stress. So,
yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, a few things. I think for any human, you know, when we start feeling, one of the things that can contribute to this experience of overwhelm, and, you know, sort of this fight, flight, freeze or faint, which is the fear mechanism, you know, that lives within all of us, is first and foremost this feeling of sort of helplessness.
Yes.
You know, right, where we feel like there's nothing we can do. And I think that's the first place for people to start, is by recognizing, you know, I hate to keep coming back to brushing my teeth, but I'm going to. you know, the way that, I know, the weirdest talk I've given ever. But the way that you, you know, use up a tube of toothpaste is one squeeze at a time, right? So I think that it's helpful for people to keep in mind that oftentimes it's not the big sweeping action that we take that makes all the difference. It is the small things that we do repeatedly over and over again, and the place where we can, to your point, have influence. It's the moment that, you know, if there's trash laying in the, you know, walkway that you choose to bend down and pick up the trash because you prefer the trash not to be there. You know, your neighbor doesn't pick up after their dog and you'd like to have it picked up. Maybe you say something to the neighbor, but first and foremost, you just pick it up. So I think that reminding people and really letting people remember the levels of influence that they have all the time, I think is really important. When it seems like the forces of the world can be getting the best of us, you know, it's remembering that we can have, it's the small things that we do, it's the small actions that we take over and over again that help. I think the second part is also finding the places where we don't feel so alone. And I think one of the challenges in our modern world, to your point earlier, is we have started to and can become, and I think this could happen this happened any time in our history, but probably more so now, where we can start to feel very isolated and kept away from one another versus really being able to connect with the other humans. That's the chapter on friendship, quite honestly, in my book, because of you know, I can get on social media and I feel like I'm having some form of connection, which it is, by the way. It is one form of creating some form of connection, but it isn't the same as, wow, who will be here for me, you know, when I'm struggling? Who can I reach out to? And it only takes one person, you know, one person to care about us, one person for us to remember that we care about them. And we have people that care about us, you know, our benefactors. So I really encourage people and support people having a couple of those reflections, you know, where can you help? And who is there for you when you need help? You know, there's one person, you know, and if we pay real close attention, we can even find it in the strangers that we see on the street, you know, the person that smiles at you for no good reason, you know, the person that holds the door for you when you're having a challenge, you know, we can see these momentary, you know, momentary and yet fleeting moments of kindness all the time they're out there. Again, if we just pay attention. So I think when the chips are down, it feels like the chips are down, remembering these things can be really helpful. And I think the third part of that is, you know, remembering those who may be suffering more than we might and how we can influence those situations too. And I think that's, you know, for me, I have a roof over my head. I'm, you know, you can't tell, but I'm well clothed at the moment, you know, clothes on. I'm not out in the cold anywhere. And I think that's really helpful to remember, like, how we can send our good wishes and take care of the people around us. I think really starts to pull us out of our own sort of our own little place in our mind where, you know, we're more concerned about just our well-being than everybody else's. And what can we do? You know, put the coat back on the hanger as best we can. So I think those are the things that help me remember who I am in the world and not let me get too caught up that it's all doom and gloom. There's nothing I can do. And boy, we're screwed now, you know, that sort of conversation really throws us into resignation pretty quickly or into extreme anger, which also, you know, isn't ultimately helpful.
That's what I was going to suggest that as well. This extreme, well, there's extreme, there's variety to this, right? There's extreme anger.
Yeah, totally.
There's extreme anxiety. Let's take like climate. Yeah. Let's take climate change. I mean, There's sentiment that, you know, we were really on a precipice here, and that we've got to be very careful. And so, I mean, if you take, I would say an existential crisis. Okay, I think that there's some things that are causing that, and one of them is climate change.
Yeah.
And that there's a perception, and I'm not saying that I'm necessarily part of this perception or believe in this perception, but it's almost like I'm just maybe in denial. But you know, like we've got a shot here, and if we don't do the right thing, we're going to be in deep shit because we already are in deep shit.
Mm-hmm.
So what that does is it puts a lot of pressure on. Oh my God, if you know if our tenant doesn't win, it's going to be, you know, worse, and maybe so. So the point of the story is we're anticipating what could happen, and that is, which is much more dire than it already is. It already is dire.
Yeah.
So yeah. So that is influencing and our decision about what we're doing, and it causes more anxiety, and it causes more frustration. And so going back to your idea around what little thing can we do, like what are some ideas around that? And I'm not talking specifically about that situation, but just generally these are broad, very broad issues I think that are touching us, and they're actually, some of it is very unconscious. We don't think about that much, but then when we do, it causes a lot of anxiety, so we decide, okay, we're not going to think about it anymore. That's one way of dealing with it. I kind of went little when we first started, like the small anxiety, small stress. I kind of went much bigger now. I mean, this is the most existential crisis you could think about because it's our very existence at all. But so talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's all the same thing in a sense that it's not a, you know, a big thing, small thing when we're working with the mind. It does the same. Mm-hmm. It only has really, you know, one bag of tricks. So when we talk about climate change or we talk about, you know, which person would represent this interest the best, you know, we're going to make a decision about what we vote. The truth is, if you look at what's like right now in this moment, there's one candidate that we know will be on the ballot. We don't know who the next one is. And
right.
I think the point that I'm wanting to make there is, so for right now, we really, really worrying ourselves about that really isn't going to help. If you just use your logic for a second, that isn't really going to help. Climate change and what we know now and what needs to happen, worrying about it isn't really helpful. Somebody one time gave me this example that worrying is like being in a rocking chair. It feels like you're doing something, but you're really not getting anywhere, you know, and except more stress. We're adding more stress to ourselves. So again, if we can really pay attention, like, wow, you know, I'm reading all this data. I'm hearing the science on climate change. Holy smokes. You know, what can we do? What can I do? What can I do to influence this? What can I do to be a positive, you know, if you will, for lack of a better description, force for change, you know, which candidate do I think if that, you know, is on the ballot here, which candidate do I think would represent this interest the most, you know, if this is important to me, all, you know, and many things can seem important. And so worrying about it, I think, in a sense that we're not able to take wise action and use our best wisdom, I think, is where we really want to. I think that's the thing we really want to keep waking up to. You know, how did we all collectively get here? I think is a really great question without any blame or judgment or criticism attached to that. But you know, I can look in my life very easily and put the spotlight on. Gosh, you know, I didn't really think about any of this. You know, if I look at the amount of things that I've consumed in my life, you know, all those resources have to come from somewhere. You know, I think it's a really good time to say, okay, you know, how can I live more wisely right now? And there are a million and one ways that can happen, you know. So I'm a big fan of really looking at what is actually happening, what's really here right now, and what can I do, and where do I get myself so caught up in stories of the future that I'm not able to even take wise action right now, you know. And I think that's the best we can do.
Right. So instead of worrying about who we're voting for, you know, stop driving and go start driving a diesel or electric car. You know, it's like, do the things you can do.
But I think it is those moment by moment, you know, awareness and those moment by moment choices that we have to not add that second arrow to an already like, oh crap, you know, we kind of screwed this up.
We screwed it up more by adding an arrow.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I really appreciated your analogies, your metaphors. I'm actually writing them down. I'm going to repeat them for people in case you didn't get them. When you're adding the arrow, you're making something that's already hard worse. Worrying is like a rocking chair. It's like you have some movement, but it doesn't really go anywhere. But my favorite has to be the coat falling. I'm going to leave the brushing the teeth one over here, but the coat falling off the hanger. Not that one is not my favorite. My favorite is the coat falling off the hanger. I love that.
Okay.
You didn't like
the toothpaste?
It's all right. The coat falling off the hanger is like awesome. Like just noticing, that coat fell off the hanger. I assume that you've studied Buddhism because some of the way you're talking is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
And I have too. And people can't believe I've actually done 5-day retreats, but
me either.
But I actually have a couple times. Anyway, but I think the thing that I take away from my teachers there is that, you know, whatever it is, you have to just let things be what they're going to be. And maybe that's only for 2 seconds, but you got to look at it as it is. And so I translate into, like, you have to assess what's going on before you can start, truly start judging it, but hopefully you're not judging it, but until you can start doing something about it. That's how I try to live what I do every day. I'm not great at it, but I give myself a B, probably, on that stuff. But but anyway, this has been lovely. I really appreciate it, listening to your wisdom, and I love, as I said, love the analogies. And I want to make sure that that people know where to get a hold of you. Is the best way to do that through your website?
Yeah, sure. So my website, daphne-scott.com, and then my email, I can give you my email too. It's daphne@daphne-scott.com. So happy
Perfect.
To have anybody reach out. Yeah.
Right. Great. And then on Twitter, you're @DaphneScott. So that makes it all very easy.
Yeah.
Really, really, truly appreciate our time together today. And want to encourage everybody to send out, we'll have the videotape, or not the video, the audio on our website by Monday. And we also are, of course, on our podcast. You can get us on Apple. So, again, just send it out to people. I'm sure, Dan, that you'll hopefully put it on your website as well. And, yeah, so thanks again for being with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation. You're great, and it was super fun for me, so I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Oh, I try to make it fun. So before you go, let me just say to everybody, we have somebody coming, as we do every month, February 25th, 2020. I think it's very fun to be able to say 2020, at 11 a.m. With Matt Morris. He is the author of, I love this title, Unzip Your Mind, How to Be Vulnerable in a Depressed World. Wow. Okay. get some people just by that title. So how to be more vulnerable. I think we talked a lot about that today. I think being slowing down and being less distracted and noticing what's going on is certainly a type and an aspect of vulnerability. So thanks again, Daphne. I really appreciate it. And we'll see everybody next month, February 25th. Bye now.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.